ॐ अग्नतिमिरन्दस्याग्नञ्जन शलाकय चक्षुर्निरितां तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः अखण्डमण्डलाकरां व्याप्तयेन चराचरं तत्पदां दर्शितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः पञ्चकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभ्य एव च पतितानां पवनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः यस्या प्रसादाग्यपि साध्यः सार्वज्ञतां व्रजेत् स श्रीचैतन्यदेवमेव भगवान् सम्प्रसीदतु जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिवासति गौर भक्तवृंद हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे Ishopanishad is one of the 11 most important Upanishads which are commented upon by all the main acharyas, beginning with Shankaracharya and all the sampradayas, all the lines of teachers. They have commentaries on the Ishopanishad. By the mercy of Banuswami, we have translations of them in English. We have here Madhvacharya's commentaries, very interesting, then Vedanta Dashika, that represents commentary from Ramanuja Acharya Sampradaya, and also in our Sampradaya, Baladeva Vidyabhushan and Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Amazingly enough, he also wrote a commentary. They say also Baladeva Vidyabhushan wrote commentaries on the other main Upanishads, like Shvetashvatara, Taittiriya, Chandogya, but until today these commentaries could not have been found. So this is the only commentary by him on the Upanishads that we have, on Ishopanishad. It's very interesting. So, so far we have discussed mantras from 1 to 11, correct? And today, Krishna willing, we will discuss mantras 12 and 13, maybe 14. So, the Upanishad begins with stating how everything is complete. So Upanishad speaks famous invocation, everything is the absolute Om Purnamada Purnamidam. The absolute is complete and this world is complete or perfect. And although everything is coming from the complete remains complete. So 1 minus 1 equals 1. So this is higher calculus. It's not the ordinary arithmetics, but in mathematics it's there, like in the theory of sets, when we have sets of infinity. So infinity plus infinity is infinity, infinity minus infinity is infinity. Yes? If you remember the theory of sets. I remember we had one academician who read Bhagavad Gita, and he was so inspired by the Bhagavad Gita that he was inviting us for the meetings of their scientific club. So he had all the professors come, and he was inviting us to speak about Krishna consciousness, and he was literally on fire. He was saying that these things, how unlimited can be present in a limited, we came to understand this only in the 18th century, and we came to understand that only in that century, but we see in the Bhagavad Gita thousands of years ago it is already there. And he gave a very beautiful example how unlimited can be, how unlimited Lord can be present in a limited space, like in an atom. He gave this example how pens. Do you know where pens are? We have one pen, at least. What should we do? Should I write here? Anyway, I can write here. So he, being an academician, he was able to explain things very simple. In a very simple way. So he said we can have a like half circle which is of limited length, yes, and we can have a straight line. We can have a straight line which is unlimited in length. Yeah, very good, thank you. And then he says we can take a point here and we can find a correspondence between each line on the unlimited straight line and a point on this limited half circle by connecting them with this point in center. So to one point on this unlimited straight line, we can find a corresponding one point in on this half circle. Well, I didn't write straight lines, so it doesn't look quite good. But you get the point that he showed how this is unlimited, has no end, but no matter how far you can draw a line from any point, you can draw a line connecting with this point, and it will cross the half circle in one point. So there is the, according to mathematics, the number of points on the unlimited line and on this limited half circle is the same. So the quantity, this infinity and that infinity are the same. Infinity. It's in mathematics, it's called a continuum. So between any two points, you can find a third point, one more point. And he was really ecstatic when he was discussing this. And he was speaking about spiritual world and material world, Krishna being present everywhere. Unfortunately, he already left this world. He wrote a book about how about spaces and how can subspace be a space in itself. So mathematically, many of the complicated concepts which are difficult to take for a materialistic mind are, in fact, explainable, although it's a higher mathematics. So we had this first mantra saying how from complete absolute comes complete world, and the living entities are also complete. And Krishna uses this mantra to prove that he is a person and he has a form, because if we, which are products of that unlimited absolute, have form and are persons, then if he would be lesser than us, if he lacked what his little particles have. So he's also a person. And then the Upanishad begins. So first is Ishavasyam, the principle of Ishavasyam, that everything is controlled and enjoyed by the Lord, Isha. So by understanding this, an intelligent person is encouraged to surrender, tyaktena, to offer everything to the Lord, to act without the spirit of the enjoyer and the controller. And when we learn to act like this, then mantra 2 says we can live happily as long as it, as for 100 years. 100 years is more like symbolic, that you can live a full life, or as long as it takes to become completely self-realized, become completely liberated. Because one can think that, okay, if he is the controller and he is the owner, why should I work? I should just give up work, go to the forest, or just lie on the sofa, or sit on the welfare, or whatever, I don't know. And Upanishad says, no, perform your duty. And then speaks about the responsibility of human, that human life is the life of responsibility, that we are not just conditioned robots. We are not just a product of matter, which is completely bound. In other words, we have a choice. That's why we have scriptures in every culture. Every culture has scriptures which teach us to do or not do something. And after that, who is this Isha about whom we speak? What are the qualities of this Lord? So we have 4 and 5 very contradictory qualities. He moves and he doesn't move. He is fixed in one place, but he is faster than the demigods, the controlling demigods of the world. Anybody remembered to remember some of his qualities during japa? Anybody remember? Okay, very good. So when we chant, when we do our japa meditation in a conscious way, it makes the quality much deeper. And then we discussed the loving vision of love. When a person becomes perfect, a saint, he sees the Lord in everything and everything in the Lord. Krishna in everything, Krishna in all, and all in Krishna. This is the loving vision. And then the result is that the person becomes free from lamentation, fear, and illusion. Yes. And the reason for that was mantra 8, because the Lord is free from lamentation, fear, and illusion. He is omnipotent. He doesn't have a material body. Yeah, so this is, we have some qualities from mantra 8 here. He is omnipresent, omnipotent, unembodied. He doesn't have a material body. He doesn't have a gross body and doesn't have a subtle body. But still, he is self-sufficient philosopher. Yes, he is greatest of all. He fulfills desires of everyone since time immemorial. So he is a person. He has he is a transcendental person, and he has a transcendental form. And now, the next part, which we discussed yesterday, was these three mantras. They come in echoes, like 4 and 5, 6 and 7. So here we have these three mantras, and echoed by these three mantras, speaking about the necessity of balance. So how to work properly. This is the difficulty. This is the secret. That's why yoga is so difficult to grasp, even for someone who is practicing for a long time. That's why Ishupanishad has to emphasize surrender, be renounced, detached, but work. So this goes against our grain. Arjuna also, in the battlefield, he wanted to give up everything and go to the forest. Because, okay, I don't want the kingdom, I don't want to enjoy. And Krishna says, good, that's very good. You don't want to enjoy, you don't want a kingdom? Wonderful. That's what makes you qualified to hear what I have to say. So now fight. But how? Like that, without tyaktena, with surrender, without any material desires. So if we go to the extreme, so mantras, the first mantras in these two triplets, mantra 9 and mantra 12, describe the extremes. They say, if you worship ignorance, avidya, you go to hell. But if you worship knowledge, you go to an even worse hell. Yeah? And we spoke that there are three kinds of knowledge, or so-called knowledge, in that present, in this present edition of translation, it makes it easy, because it says not just knowledge, but so-called knowledge. So yeah, of course, we already, Dzogchen Ganten, yeah. And do you have, I think it's the general here. Because if you look in the Sanskrit, it doesn't say so-called knowledge, it says just knowledge. Scheinwissen, it's also like apparent knowledge. Yeah. So it can be knowledge. So Prabhupada, in his commentary, he speaks about three kinds. He speaks about we spoke about vikarmi, karmi, and akarmi. So one is just materialistic knowledge. So this is simply knowledge of how to satisfy bodily demands. Just something for the body. Am I going too far out of the range? Then we have even knowledge of the Vedic rituals. So this is religious knowledge. These karmis, they are following Veda, they are following religion, but while following religion, they are just following a ritual. And we discussed how we were very often not attracted by so-called religion, because ritual. Most of us were yogis in our past lives, and just having a ritual is not enough. We don't want a ritual in itself. We want something that brings us to a higher goal. We want something that produces a transcendental result, that gives transcendental knowledge, right? So we are not interested in that. And then even we have those who are cultivating spiritual knowledge, but they go to the, again, to only, they take only half of it, the impersonal half, that we are all God, everything is one, we are all spirit, and what is the result? They proclaim themselves God, and they also kill the capacity, the full capacity of the soul to reawaken our eternal nature of the Lord's friend, the Lord's servant, the Lord's lover, so our eternal relationship with the Supreme Person. So this is also so-called knowledge. So these are the extremes. This is as far as knowledge is concerned. So Prabhupada even condemns materialistic education very often, saying that we don't have much against the materialistic education. I mean, a bit about education in itself, it's no problem, but the problem is rejection of God. And we see that so many really extraordinary, brilliant scientists, they were, in fact, very spiritual people and very religious people. Einstein, he was saying that this is the main question that should interest us, what is the power behind the laws, and how God creates the universe. And we spoke about his friend Gödel and his incompleteness theorem, and his book about unpublished book about proof of God, logic proof, a priori proof of existence of God, which he was shy to publish. So this is the first mantra. Then the second mantra speaks about that those who are belonging to the line of parampara, the line of gurus, the cyclic succession, they say that no, knowledge and ignorance, they are still different. And then the third gives the synthesis. So there's thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. So anybody, so let me ask you, who tried to find some examples of extreme manifestations of knowledge and extreme manifestations of ignorance? And what is the result, Christian? So we can maybe put, what should we put? We may put, so we can take this as a thesis, as the materialistic proposition, just enjoy, right? So from our point of view, this will be avidya. We can write here avidya. Avidya, and then the opposite will be vidya, knowledge. So what are some possible examples? So on ritualistic brahmanas, okay. So they accept Veda, they accept some kind of science, some kind of knowledge, but this leads. They remain bound. They remain basically on the materialistic level. All right. So since I wrote Vidya here, we can put them. And Prabhupada puts them as Veda, Vadarata, Karmis. So we can write them here. Ritualistic priests. Okay. Who? Pseudo-religionists. Sentimental religionists. Okay. Yes. Okay. So pseudo-religionists or sentimental. Yeah, very nice. So this is from mantra 12. Yeah, this is from today's mantra. Voltat Mm-hmm. Okay, so we can, so in ISKCON, in our society, it can be, this can be only service, you can say, right? And no study, no knowledge. Prabhupada was complaining that my only complaint about disciples is that they don't study my book. And then, of course, it was a loving complaint, and it's not about all disciples. And the others are, so they only philosophy. They only study philosophy. And no action. No action and no application. No action and no application. All right? Okay, very good. Something else you have? Tulsi Toshi Kamadaji? Okay, Ritviks. So they, okay. So this is an extreme. So again, they are going to one extreme. Where do we fit them? All right. So Vedavadarata. So they are just formally, okay. Formal following. Okay. So Ritviks. Ritvik. Formal following. Something else?
We speak so much that Krishna had many names, but somehow we always criticize the other religions in which we are Christians. This would be also in the B. And the B that I mean, that they understand that Krishna had many names, but if some name that's not Indian, then
Mm-hmm. All right. So this will be which extreme? Not enough knowledge, or what? Just taking. Okay. So this will be like just taking care of. This will be like sectarianism, accepting that only our group is so to say has it. And only our group understands who's God, and everybody else is wrong. So this will be. So we can say in avidya, right? So only without realizing the absolute and all-pervading nature of Krishna, of God. Okay, so we can say sectarianism here. All right, sectarianism. Sectarianism. All right. Something else?
Yes, our Western basic education leads also just to avidya.
Okay, so modern education. Prabhupada was complaining that who studies the soul? Where is this? Where we can find any study of the soul? And even though there is so much empiric hard evidence about reincarnation, people. There are so many people who wanted to defeat the idea of reincarnation and ending up just finding confirmation that actually there are people who remember and actually there are and the details match and so many children actually remember correctly and again details match from the past life and. Or the near-death experiences, that those who go through near-death experience, they actually have a correct, very correct picture of the surgery that was performed or whatever, or the conversations of their relatives in nearby rooms or whatever was happening around. They have correct memories, and those who didn't have near-death experiences, they try to, make a guess what they were speaking, and it was totally wrong. So they ended up discovering that yes, there is a possibility of existence. It's outside the body, and it's hard empirical evidence. It's not like it's very experimental and very very concrete, but people reject. Okay, so you can say materialistic science or materialistic education. All right. Okay. Today we are moving into more religious. So this was speaking about vidya and avidya, which is definitely has religious connotations, but today we move more into the religious realm. Maybe you can turn it a little, because otherwise I cannot reach. I want to go near Christian, near people. Let us chant mantra 12. We can chant all three mantras to get the perspective all together. Andham tama pravishanti ye sambhutim upasate tato bhuya evate tamo yau sambhutyam rata. Those who are engaged in the worship of demigods enter into the darkest region of ignorance, and still more so do the worshippers of the impersonal absolute. So the editor made it very simple by saying impersonal absolute, but again, originally it was just the absolute. And in Sanskrit it is also sambhuti and asambhuti, that which is absolute and that which is not absolute. Are these the limits? Or okay. Absolute and not absolute. Now, so again, we see it's a shocker. Yes? You worship non-absolute, you go to hell. Okay, that's kind of clear. You worship something temporary, something limited, and you go to dark regions, hell, yeah, tama, ignorance. Okay, that's kind of understandable. But you worship absolute, and you end up even worse. So this is, what do you mean? How is that? And then mantra 13 reconfirms our doubts by saying, let's chant. Anyat evahu sambhavat, anyat ahura sambhavat, iti susrumadhiranam yenastad vichachakshire. It is said that one result is obtained by worshipping the supreme cause of all causes, and that another result is obtained by worshipping what is not supreme. Yeah, that's what we think. All this is heard from the undisturbed authorities who clearly explained it. So this is So this is coming from parampara, from undisturbed, from self-controlled saints and teachers who know the difference. So, okay, so then how do we reconcile this with verse 12, with the first verse here, that results are different? And mantra 14 gives the synthesis here. So doing through thesis and antithesis, it's not enough, it's on the same level. So mantra 14 offers the synthesis, the combination of these two. Let us chant mantra 14. Sambhutim cha vinasam cha yastad vedo vayam saha vinase namrityum tirtva sambhutyamritam asnute. One should know perfectly the personality of Godhead Shri Krishna and his transcendental name, form, qualities and pastimes, as well as the temporary material creation with its temporary demigods, men and animals. So this is a very expanded translation. Basically, Sanskrit says, you should know the absolute and you should know the temporary, vinasham, that which is destroyed. When one knows these, he surpasses death and the ephemeral cosmic manifestation with it. And in the eternal kingdom of God, he enjoys his eternal life of bliss and knowledge. And so Sanskrit is very beautiful, just as it was in the 11th verse. It says, where it says, "By ignorance you conquer death, and by knowledge you conquer immortality. You get immortality." So the same it says here: by non-absolute, by relative you conquer death, and by the absolute you gain immortality. You gain the eternal life. So in other words, if we put it simple, in simple terms, by taking care of the body, observing the laws of material world and material nature, we can keep the body healthy, as we discussed yesterday. So materialism is like a fever, so we are not trying to increase the fever to the point of death, 42 degrees. We are now at 39 degrees, so we don't want to increase it to 42. When the protein in the body starts curdling, starts dying. But then again, we are not trying to reduce it to zero. So as Buddhism calls it, we need a middle path. Yeah, so we need to find the proper balance. How to act, how to accept, how to support the body and respect all the material laws, but at the same time achieve the absolute. So in short, it was already there in the first mantra, tena tek tena. So we work, we offer everything to the Lord, but we do with responsibility everything that's our duty, without attachment. This is yoga, and this is very difficult, because if I'm doing something and results are coming, it's so difficult to renounce. It's so natural to just accept, whether it's praise or whatever it is. And if there are no results, and if I have to renounce results, then the natural temptation, the natural decision is that, why work? Right? If I have to be detached, why should I work? That's the usual approach. Only, you know, very binary, yes or no. You have some. Whereas we need a synthesis. Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
So sometimes I'm surprised why they advised the newcomers to do that.
Yeah, that was this neophyte enthusiasm or fanaticism.
Fanaticism,
yes. Which is even if maybe well intentioned, is not correct, and it's not our philosophy.
No, it is not. When you read this, it's completely opposite.
Yes. Yes, it. In fact, these middle mantras, which six mantras, it's like the bigger part of the Upanishad. They encourage balance, and just in general, we know that, you know. I was telling Prahladananda Swami a few days ago in Radhadesh. He was giving a class, and he said that when we join, we are completely not the body. Yes, I'm not the body, and we neglect the body. And we serve and serve and serve, and then after, and then when we, as the joke, when we hit 40, you know, there's this expression in English, hit 40. So when you hit 40, means you become 40 years of age. Then 40 hits back. It's the joke. And then all of a sudden, I am completely the body. I am just the body, because everything is already sick and destroyed, and so now, as you said, taking care of the body becomes my full-time service. just to be alive, you know, just to function a little bit. I have to spend all my day just to keep me in operational order. Yeah. So yeah, that's what Prabhupada was complaining about. Study my books. It's all there. That's the whole Bhagavad Gita. That's the whole thing that Bhagavad Gita speaks about. Arjuna wanted to run away to the forest. Krishna said, "You can, but it will not work. It's not gonna help, because not just by stopping work you become renounced, as we all know. If I just stop acting, I do not become renounced all of a sudden. As I told you, I was a Buddhist before I became a devotee, and I dropped my university. Even if I met devotees by that time, although they were also maybe probably too exuberantly, enthusiastically fanatical, I don't know. There are different kinds, but maybe I would finish the university. Although I don't, I have no regrets because I spent my 10 years after I joined translating books and traveling in different places and doing all kinds of good things. So I guess, although I still sometimes miss mathematics a little bit, make something with mathematics, but I had a good use of my time. And for the last 10 years, I'm studying in Vrindavan in India, studying the scripture, the Shastra. But yes, so I left my home, and because you know I was a Buddhist, so all I wanted was nirvana, you know, just liberation. And why do you need to study? You know, all I saw in study that what do? You study for what? Just to work? Just to earn money? And but what's the point of earning money? And then what? So you earn money, and then what? So I thought, no, I want to go to the monastery. So I hitchhiked from West Ukraine, this is near Poland, you know, 8,000 kilometers to north of Mongolia. Like that, I chose a time when parents were not home. I was 18 or 17, 18 years old, I think, something like that. And of course, on the way, I met devotees and I started chanting Hare Krishna. So that was good, but they didn't have an ashram. So if they had an ashram, I would have joined immediately. They didn't have an ashram, so I was singing Hare Krishna, but I kept going. I was sleeping in forests, and it was a lot of fun. And then I came to that Buddhist monastery, and it turned out you cannot just join. It was again, there was some bureaucracy, you know, still this, it was long ago, it was still the bureaucratic communistic approach to everything. So then I decided, okay, anyway, I'll just go to the forest, I'll live as a sannyasi, I'll just renounce everything and I will live in the forest. And so I can tell you many things about the forest and forest life, how to live in the forest, especially in Siberia, you know, when it's really cold. this is some adventure. But what was funny is that after a few days, so first thing, I remembered my friends. In a dream, I remembered my friends. And I started thinking, oh, my friends, such good guys. They understood me, and they are really intelligent, and they're all really, really nice people. And then I saw them in my dream. Then I started thinking about my grandfather, and I thought, oh, he was a priest, and he was a very sincere person, and he knew herbs. He could go to the forest and collect some herbs, and he knew which herbs cure what and how to use them for treating people, and he's a very wise person, and I never took advantage of, you know, learning something from him in that regard. And after a few days, I started remembering my parents, from which I ran away, and I was surprised that all the things I thought are an obstacle from the outside, they're actually, and I thought I don't want them. I have to give them up. Turned out that it's all inside, that I'm attached, that this hatred or sometimes repulsion or desire to give up, it's in fact the other side of attachment, and I'm actually attached. And then after a few days I thought, well, after all, I could maybe, you know, become a forester and live in a forest, you know, with nature, and just, you know, live in a sattvic, in a peaceful way, and just, you know, read my sutras in the forest and meditate, and what's the need of just as Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, if you just renounce, if you just stop working, stop acting, doesn't mean you become free, not at all. Because freedom, we are bound not externally. We are not bound by external things, we are bound internally. We are bound by our attachments inside, identification. And oftentimes our so-called hatred is just that it's just attachment. It's why do we rebel against our parents or something? Because we actually want something from them and we're getting something different. And there is attachment beneath it. And then when I actually joined, there was an ashram finally in our city, and I was on the street distributing books. And it was a very active expansion at that time. And some days I was distributing, we were distributing lots of books, and some days, every day I had a big wad of money. I would just have a real, you know, pack of money in my back pocket, something that people would earn probably in half a year, I guess. Yeah. We were distributing actually hundreds of books. We were like two people or three, and we didn't even like go from. We just had a table, and we were just, you know, people were coming. I was eating good food, very nice prasadam. You know, prasadam is usually very tasty, spices, this, that. But I remember that as I was doing this, and you know, in the city and sleeping, in the heart, I was experiencing the same processes occurring as I had when I was living in the forest. Some purification, yeah? Like, you know, like you remember some attachment, and it's coming up, and it's like, and you think, will I ever do this again? And then you think, no, I will not do this. And then, you know, the heart becomes purified. You're not. And then I realized, well, I'm dealing with packs of money, and I'm eating nice food, and I'm, you know, having great association. And I'm in my native city. I'm seeing my parents regularly and everything. And but actually, being transformed in the same way as I was transformed as I was in the forest, when I was in the forest living alone. So this is yoga, and this is much more effective. So especially bhakti yoga, yoga of service, loving service to Krishna. This is much more powerful than than just renunciation. Any questions or points here? Sorry. Yes.
Many people say, "Oh yeah, I give up everything."
Yes.
And then the idea comes not to work.
Yes. Yes.
It's just for a few weeks, and then after
yes.
They have to earn money, maybe they want to get married, and
then yes.
Children.
Yes.
I mean, you also said you wanted to become a monk, you wanted to go to the monastery.
And, you know, it's a standard mistake. It's mistake number one of any person who becomes interested in transcendental activity, philosophy, yoga, anywhere. It's a classic, it's the number one mistake. Give up work. And this is what these mantras are dealing with, the extremism. Yes? Being extreme. That only, being too spiritual too quick. Too spiritual too quick.
You think you can just leave everything behind?
Yes. Like one of my friends, he was saying that he was joining the temple, and then he thought that he was actually a businessman and quite successful. He was getting quite some money, and he was always postponing. He was saying, "Yes, this is the right philosophy, and I want to just give. I just want to move into the temple, become a monk." But then he thought, "Well, I'll just earn another 10,000. Just another 10,000. I'll get, and then I will go." And then over a period of, I forgot how much, 1 month or 2 months, he lost everything.
He lost everything. He was over. And then he thought, well, maybe now is a good time to join. And then he says he moved into the temple. And then he thought, I don't have warm winter boots. And winter is coming. You know, now, okay, now it's warm, now it's summer, and then in half a year it's going to be autumn, and I will need winter boots. And I've given everything. And then he thought, anyway, it's going to be after half a year. After half a year, I will already be self-realized. And I will not need any boots. I will just be transcendental, you know. I will be transcendental to heat and cold, and it will be all the same. So that's what we were feeling, actually, right? That's actually what we thought. And it was a fantastic feeling, right? You were thinking that, yes, just a little bit more. Just, you know, just surrender, and yes, and then you fly. And you... Oh, this enthusiasm. And in that enthusiasm, sometimes we did stupid things too. Sometimes very stupid things. So that's why it's good to have some more mature, experienced people around. And also that's why it's good to study what the Ishopanishad says, which has the wisdom, you know, from thousands and thousands of years, and which teaches us how to do this right. And, you know, the funny thing, the worst thing is that you may renounce, but you don't get, actually, you do not become renounced. We go to that through from the wrong end. We start from the wrong end. Like somebody may give up their family, for example. They may have some family and even children. Yes, and they say, no, this is Maya. This is illusion. I just join. I just become a monk. And usually we see what happens. We see that, you know, because they actually gave suffering to their family, then for some maybe years they are a monk. Then it catches up, and then they have to they marry again, right? And then they have another family, and then it becomes, you know, just what was the point? Why did you give up that family? Why did you give suffering to these people? You know, where was your renunciation? It's not just that just by external giving up things you become renounced. So yoga means we keep working until but give up the fruits, give up the attachments. So these three mantras here, they speak about the extremes. So the mantra about worshipping the Absolute is more striking. And understood in the most shocking way, it means that when you worship something temporary, you go to hell. So that's understood, that's clear. It means you're just reborn. You're born again in the material, dark material world. But if you worship only God without respect to anybody else, you know, if you're becoming disrespectful, then the result may be even worse. As I spoke about fanatical Christianity, which ended up depicting God as a monster, basically, yes, who sends for one thought crime sends people to eternal damnation, to burn in hell eternally, for one, you know, one thought crime, not even a sin external, but just wrong conception. They thought wrong, and then eternally they will burn. So I mean, if a person does something like this, we will call police and ask to put him in a psychiatric ward if somebody does it to their children. You know, oh, he did wrong, you let him burn. But when God does something like this, so of course, naturally, that's very natural that atheism comes up and people reject what kind of God it is. How can he be God? How can he be kind? How can he accept such a God? I've met many Muslims. I've been in Muslim countries a lot, and the terrorism of Muslims, it's a political...
I'm not talking about that, but their Allah is also, in some ways, quite totalitarian to the individual. If you do not completely surrender, you're going to hell. So the German word Anspruch, the requirement, in a sense, is similar.
The declaration, yeah. Yeah, that's a good point.
There's no atheism in that part of the world.
I guess that was probably connected with the culture, because they still have a rather, it seems rather satisfying culture. And that's why they fight with the Western influence. I don't know if you ever traveled in Muslim countries.
A bit, yeah?
It's quite amazing. They're very hospitable, very warm and very personal in their dealings. You feel like, they really have relationships. They value relationships highly, and it's quite satisfying. So that's why they probably still keep to that. Yeah, I remember Uzbekistan, Muslim country, but I was traveling like this, and in the evening we stopped to pass water, on the way, in the car. So I went to some house looking for a dark corner, and then the master of the house came out, and then he saw me, definitely not looking like a Muslim or something, or not. So he saw me, and then he said, good evening. It was dark, in the dark, some person, lurking around in the back of his house, just dealing or something. So he saw me, he said, good evening. And then he said, would you like to, please come, would you like to have a meal? Are you traveling? Do you want to have a meal? I said, oh, no, thank you. Sorry, I'm just, you have a car, you continue after a few minutes. So then he said, okay, then at least please come and take a little tea, or at least take some water, take something. So that's the culture. I was thinking, wow, that's that's something.
Yeah, I mean, I have similar experience. I think the cultural aspects, I have quite a bit of affinity.
Yeah.
Quite
terrifying.
Dogma, very much of a
strict,
unflexible, closed system.
Yeah, so I guess in the West, what contributed was the problem with the culture falling apart, and then the God didn't look very attractive, and so people felt the freedom to give him up. Whereas in the Muslim countries, even though God still doesn't look very attractive, it depends how you depends on who do you speak to. Like in another place, I think I mentioned we spoke to a chief imam of a big Muslim country, but he was a Sufi, so this is a more spiritual direction, and then he spoke to us, and then he found some surah from Quran, and then he said, I can come to the conclusion that you Hare Krishnas must be a bona fide religion, you must be an authorized religion, but you belong to that part which is not mentioned in Quran. So in Quran it mentions that there are some prophets which are correct but are not mentioned openly. So I conclude that you must belong to that kind of... And he was very... And we came to his mosque on 12,000 people are coming to the service on that mosque. And we were there, and everybody was greeting us very, very warmly. And he also had a... After the service, he invited us to him. And on the table, he said, I don't know what you drink. So he had like a choice of 15 different, he had Coca-Cola, he had plain water, gas, carbonized water, this water, that water, he had everything, juice, and he said, so, sorry, I don't know what exactly is your diet, so please you can choose what you and he and what really impressed me was that he was humble. Usually if you have the chief, you know, in the Muslim country, the chief Muslim, which means he has some all kinds of powers, the person doesn't tend to be very humble. But he was actually humble. It was very impressive for me. So that means he got it right. And he said, we do not agree with Taliban, and we do not agree with that picture that we should kill or we should condemn whoever is not following, you know, our strict line. So there are this kind of Muslims too. Anyway, but thank you for this point. It's an insightful and thoughtful point in protection of Christianity.
Very well. We just have the same phenomenon in Judaism, the Old Testament.
Yes, yes.
It's a frightening God.
Yeah, all three share this.
They share the same lineage, right?
There's something about that region, you know. Abrahamic religions. Okay. All right, we've been going for quite a long time. So what shall we do? I guess, why don't we do some exercise right now? Why don't we... Because I'm feeling a little bit pinned here. I want to go close to people and okay. It's the best thing, you know, when you are teaching something and then it sorry. It's best to come close, because if the teacher comes close, it's very difficult to fall asleep. You know, it feels very reinvigorating.
All right.
Okay. No, I'll be here and there to make it more fun for you. All right. So the first mantra. It says, those who worship non-absolute, they go to hell. Those who worship absolute go to an even worse hell. So, relative or non-absolute. So, this we know. This we see that they go to the... they get rebirth. They are taking birth again and again. Now, if we take this easy translation, those who worship an impersonal absolute, just an impersonal absolute. So, the easy explanation will be like this example of Amavasya Baba. So there was this yogi in South India. Atmatata Prabhu tells about the story about him. A yogi who was living in a box, and just once a month on Amavasya, dark moon, when the moon wasn't there, he would come out. And all the villagers, he would come out and they would give him one little bowl of rice. So that was the only thing he was eating, and he wasn't drinking. So he would just once a month, he would come out, this like small box, like this. So he can imagine his position, in which position he was sitting there, in darkness. And then once a month he was coming out, and the family where he lived, they just gave him one little bowl of rice. And Atmatata Prabhu said he was there. He says all the villagers were coming to him on this day, and they were coming, oh, Swamiji, oh, Yogiji, can you please give me a blessing? And so he said, just before him there was one guy who said, Swamiji, for two times I cannot get my driving license. Please give me your blessing so I can get my driving license. So this yogi said, my God, I'm sitting here 1 month in the box and you're coming here to ask me about your driving license? It's, are you crazy? Why, this is stupid. Your desires are stupid and what you're asking is so, you know, you're coming to me and you're asking about such trivial things. When he saw devotees, he was very happy. And then he said that your path is much easier than mine. Is it because I have to, you know, I want to avoid being exposed to the external material world. So that's why I am there. So you can see that even now he's living like in hell. You know, sitting for the whole month in that box, eating just one little bowl of rice. He's already like in hell, right? Just to avoid exposure, avoid any temptation in this world, avoid any interaction in this world. So this is not what we want. And but what is it, the what other hells are there that a person who is worshipping God can achieve? So you can see, it's very interesting. Prabhupada actually indirectly writes this in the purport. He describes those who worship the demigods, how they are unintelligent because they invest the same amount of energy in worship as devotees, but the results they get are temporary because the demigods, like, you know, the many gods of India, the Indra and Ganesh and all the other demigods, they give the results maybe easier and quicker because they're like department heads, but they are temporary. And maximum you can go to their planet, to the other planet. Prabhupada is saying here that with advanced consciousness, human beings are naturally inclined to travel in outer space and to reach other planets, either by spaceships, mystic powers, or demigod worship. In the Vedic scriptures, it is said that one can reach other planets by any one of these three ways. But the most common way is by worshipping the demigod presiding over a particular planet. In this way, one can reach the moon planet, the sun planet, and even Brahmaloka, the topmost planet in the universe. However, all planets in the material universe are temporary residences. The only permanent planets are the Vaikuntha Lokas, so spiritual world. These are found in the spiritual sky, where the personality of Godhead himself predominates. As Lord Krishna states in the Bhagavad Gita, that from the highest to the lowest, all are places of rebirth. And this whole universe is covered by material elements, and this is a dark place. Even though it doesn't look like a dark place, especially today, you know, maybe yesterday, but today it looks very nice. You have sun, and it's, you know, especially here in Zurich, it looks so beautiful, green. But... You know, sun comes out and the sun comes down. So we are forced to die and we are in the darkness of our ignorance, struggling with our life, with our blind emotions. Even an intelligent person is gripped by anger, what to speak about other emotions like lust, fear, anxiety, worry, and so forth, envy, and pride. Yeah. This is all darkness. Then Prabhupada speaks about atheists and impersonalists. He says the atheist denies the existence of the Supreme Lord directly, and the impersonalists support the atheist by stressing the impersonal aspect of the Supreme Lord. Thus far, we have not come across any mantra in Sri Isha Upanishad in which the Supreme Personality of God is denied. So, 18 mantras, not a single mantra where it is denied that he is not a person, that he doesn't have a form. So, it's another argument to show that he is a person. But whereas we have many mantras which confirm that he is a person. And you mentioned about pseudo-religionists, who want to live in golden shackles, and they present a show of devotional service while indulging in all sorts of immoral activities. So, again, this is this mantra is not only... Oftentimes we think that this book is just for preaching to the outsiders, you know, to to give on the street and to preach to, oh, you are impersonalist and you are this kind of religionist and you are that kind of religionist, so only we are good. But you can see Prabhupada says here, they present a show of devotional service. So you can refer to us. We can also present a show of devotional service. You know, not the real devotional service, but we worship the Absolute. We worship the Absolute, but only as a show. In the third canto, there is a shloka. Kapila Dev says that one who worships my deity, but who neglects me in the heart of every living entity, his worship is like pouring oblations, like in sacrifice. In sacrifice, you pour ghee or something not into the fire, but into the ashes. So it's like, you know, usually in a fire sacrifice, you, like on Wednesday we are having some fire sacrifice. So you pour ghee into the fire and then it burns. But if you pour it into the ash, nothing happens. So Kapiladev, Krishna says that if you worship me as a deity in the temple, but don't try to see me in everybody's heart, then this is, you know, he calls this archavidambanam. He says this is a show of worship, one hand. On the other hand, he says it's like pouring this offering into ash, not into the fire, but into the ash.
I didn't quite get that now. In seeing God in everybody, it's like pouring the...
Not seeing.
Not seeing,
yes. So someone worships God.
Okay.
Someone worships God, but only in the temple. And he neglects other people, he neglects other devotees and so forth. So God is not happy with that. He says, I am also in their heart. So that, therefore, that worship in the temple is like pouring into the ash when you don't see me. So it is like, wow, quite startling. But of course, we have to start somewhere, and seeing in the temple is always a very clear step, as we read yesterday, for systematically seeing God. So we begin by seeing God in the temple. And then we see Him not only in the temple, but also we see, okay, those who serve in the temple, or devotees. And then gradually we see that, okay, everybody somehow or other is connected to God. Anybody tried to see God in others as an exercise over the last few days? Oh, very good. Yes. This is... did you have some positive experience by this exercise? Very good. So sometimes it's just enough to remind ourselves when we are, you know, irritated or have some negative thoughts. We can just remind ourselves, Krishna is in the heart of that person. Just stop and say this to yourself. Krishna is in the heart of that person. Krishna also directs that person. And sometimes just these simple words are helpful to change our attitude. Okay, I'm very happy that you... trying to do this. And also, I don't know how one can go to hell. We see, like, now that we have this scandal in the Catholic Church, and it's not just Catholic Church, it's just the situation in the world nowadays. So, but the Catholic Church is very prominent because they are, you know, priests in high places, and then they abuse children. So this is definitely not a very good result that they are getting from this. So therefore, Mantra 13 recommends accept the disciplic succession and basically Mantra 13 can be also used for preaching that everything is not equal, everything is not the same. So one result is achieved by one activity, another result is achieved by another activity. So Prabhupada is saying that any, so this is mantra 13, and first paragraph, second, in the middle of the second paragraph, Prabhupada says, any common man can very easily understand that a person can reach his destination only when he has purchased a ticket for that destination. A person who has purchased a ticket for Calcutta can reach Calcutta, but not Bombay. Pretty straightforward, right? So again, I'm asking you to write an essay with the arguments against Mayavad philosophy. So this is one of these arguments. We had one in the first mantra. Some other was there. So this is also a very clear argument that if you buy a ticket to Calcutta, you don't go to Bombay. Even in India, when things are mixed up, even in India, still, you will not go to Bombay, you will go to Calcutta. Maybe not to Calcutta, but not to Bombay, definitely. But the so-called spiritual masters say that any and all paths will take one to the supreme goal. Oh, do anything. You worship Ganesh, you worship Durga, you worship, you know, anything. Someone says, God is in my shoes. Yeah. It's not confirmed here by Sri Upanishad. Such mundane and compromising offers attract many foolish creatures who become puffed up with their manufactured methods of spiritual realization. Because then it means, what it means? It means I can do any damn thing and still consider that I'm a very spiritual person and I'm going to God. But spiritual path is, it said, it's as a razor blade, edge of the razor blade. Yeah, and we see that that's why we have six mantras emphasizing the necessity for this balance, how subtle it is. And these guys, they say, oh, yata mat tata pat, you know, how many monks, so many religions. Whatever, however you do, it's okay. Just go.
It's new age.
New age, yeah, it's a new age thing. Although nowadays it's changing. They are becoming a little bit more discriminating. I think it's more more insightful people are appearing on the scene. Such mundane and compromising offers attract many foolish creatures who become puffed up with their manufactured methods of spiritual realization. The Vedic instructions, however, do not uphold them. Unless one has received knowledge from the bona fide spiritual master who is in the recognized line of the cyclic succession, one cannot have the real things as it is. So, did you find it? This is 13. Right, Santos? Yeah, this is here. But, oh, you saw this in Farkarte, Nabombay. Mm-hmm. So this is here. Sorry. So, we have to worship the Supreme. And then Prabhupada gives many, many quotes from different Upanishads, from the Vedas, about Krishna and about the Supreme Lord, who is the absolute truth. So what is that absolute truth has, we discussed this yesterday with Manuel, that there are three aspects: impersonal, everything is one, so that's his effulgence. Then there is Paramatma, the super soul, expanding in every atom, every heart, and that's the controlling and knowledge giving feature. And then there is the person, the origin, who is inconceivable. So this is very, that's why Upanishads try to speak in contradictions, in paradoxical manner, so that we don't take this as, you know, just a person, you know, just some guy sitting on a cloud with a white beard or something. That even though he is a person, he's inconceivable, and his form is not material form. Yeah, his form is inconceivable. And he simultaneously is everywhere and in the same place, and in one place. So this is not a mundane, not a material person. So here in Mantra 13, we have many quotes So this is not just Prabhupada's opinion, not just one Upanishad's opinion. It's the opinion of many other scriptures. So you have Atharva Veda here, Gopaltapani Upanishad, you have Narayana Upanishad, Maha Upanishad, about the personality of Godhead, supreme personality of Godhead. And so we have to establish our faith. So as we discussed, one of the aims of study is increasing our faith and conviction. Yeah. So what is this faith? This faith that we want to increase is not a blind faith. We are not, and we accept authority of Shastra or scripture not blindly. We don't want blind acceptance. Because, again, these mantras, they condemn blind acceptance, right? So these, when they say you go to an even worse place, they actually speak about this blind acceptance and fanaticism and how much suffering we did. I myself am guilty of also being fanatical in the first days, and I actually told my, I'm sorry, you know, I have to confess. I told my best friend that, okay, you just leave your wife and just come and join. And then, and I didn't know she was pregnant at that time. And she left. He left. He came and joined. And then she was, just imagine, can imagine how she suffered. Of course, I couldn't understand why exactly, but I suffered like hell also in that time. So karma, you know, got me. And later, some years later, when they came back together, and I, you know, found them, and we like all got together, then I asked forgiveness from her, and then I found out that yes, she was actually pregnant at that time, and it was, and I did something very wrong. So this was not a good thing. So this way you see, even though I was saying, you know, worship the Absolute, right? What was the result? The result is, in fact, I created hellish suffering for others, and hellish suffering from, fortunately, by Krishna's mercy, I got immediate suffering. So immediately I got, kind of good blow on my head so that I could think better about this. But if not, then I would have to suffer in my next life, in some way or another. Even though externally it sounded like nice and pious, yeah, worship, just, you know, dedicate yourself fully to Krishna, just do everything for service of God. Yeah? What was the result? The result wasn't good. So it has to be balanced. So faith. We started to increase our faith, not to accept blindly. And the faith we want is not a blind faith. We don't need a blind faith or fanatical faith. In fact, fanatical faith is the result of lack of knowledge. That's why we are fanatical. Like the tortoise has a very hard shell. You know, tortoise? Anybody played with turtles in your childhood? Yeah, very funny, like little tanks. But why do they have such a hard shell? Because inside they have no bones. They don't have the skeleton inside, so they have to protect outside. So in the same way, if you don't have a strong understanding inside, we oftentimes compensate that by external fanaticism. So that's why also you often see that new people are fanatical, because they don't have the strong inner conviction. So we are not interested in, we don't want just a belief. When Prabhupada was asked about faith, he said, where is the question of faith? We want knowledge. It's the question of knowledge. So just like, I don't know, if I ask you, has any one of you visited, well, you're from Switzerland, so you might have traveled a lot. Well, New Zealand, any one of you was, you were okay, that didn't work, okay. Tasmania?
Australia.
But, okay, Tasmania. You visited? No? You visited Tasmania? Well, but it's, well, New Guinea, Papua or New Guinea? Anybody visited New Guinea? You didn't visit. But do you believe that New Guinea exists? You believe? But you didn't see New Guinea. But you believe, right? So, in other words, this is the kind of faith that we are looking for. It's not a belief. It's not like self-suggestion. I believe, I believe, I believe, I believe. It's knowledge about something that maybe I personally have not yet experienced completely. Maybe I saw some pictures, or I saw people who visited New Guinea, or I read it about it in a book. So I know it's there, and I may know a lot about it. So this kind of this is not really faith. It's knowledge. It's knowledge, but maybe not fully realized. I haven't myself fully experienced. So that's the kind of faith in Krishna and in the process that we need. It's knowledge, but until it is completely and fully realized, until we actually meet Krishna in all his aspects, of course all of us have some experience of Krishna, but until we experience him in his fullness, then it will be faith, and we just make our faith deeper and stronger. Any questions here?
You know this point about having faith?
Yes.
You know, when I started going to the temple first, I mean, I was looking for something because I always believed in the person at all. But then, of course, this fanatism disturbed me a little bit.
Yeah.
And then my son wanted to join, and then it almost took my breath away, you know. But somehow inside, I always had this face, it's okay, mm-hmm. It will be okay, I mean, this is just a
yes.
Face, you know. So I think, you know, the problem of Krishna will give you very self-consciousness.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's how I felt. Always something, no, it's okay, you know, when I started, you know, sort of thinking again, saw things, what happened, you know, in Hare Krishna times. Then that was the first time I felt the paramatma.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I did feel it as a child, mm-hmm. and then it faded away. So I think faith, Krishna can give you.
Yes, definitely. Especially since you were already practicing yoga in your past lives. And as I say, most people, you know, yesterday we did a little survey about some telltale signs of how can we judge if a person already practiced. And most people who are here, they have already been working. They were already practicing yoga one way or another. Most people were fasting and trying some vegetarianism or trying to do some yoga in this life already, pursuing some philosophical search. And there are some memories, some inclinations. And almost everybody was looking for some principles, for some principles in higher principles in life. And so that shows that we are continuing from before. So therefore, you already have some experience, and it's easier. And Prabhupada speaks here about gurus who call themselves God, calls themselves God, and they have their, either they themselves call themselves God, or they have their students call them God. Yeah, and when you say that, why do you call yourself God? And they say, well, I don't call myself God. That my disciples, they call me God. So, you know, I don't want to just disappoint them. But when Srila Prabhupada was called God. It happened also in our society. When she, it was in the 70s. Prabhupada was actually, I think, in Japan at that time. And 71, I think. 70 or 71. And then in America, in Vyasa Puja, we had two sannyasis. I think it's open history. I can mention it. There was Brahmananda and Gargamuni and some others. And so they came and they said, we have all made a big offense. We have all made a big mistake. Srila Prabhupada is actually God. And you are, you know, by not recognizing, we did a big offense. So we should worship him as God. He is actually God. So Prabhupada, you know, he could easily have said also, yeah, I didn't call myself God. They called me God. But what Prabhupada did, when he found out about this, he actually kicked them out of ISKCON. He came back and he said, you cannot be a part of ISKCON. So he told them, you preach. So he told them, you are wrong. This is incorrect. This is the wrong philosophy. And you call me God because you yourself want to become gods in the future. And he told them, you go preach and you cannot come to the temple until you give up this false idea. So Prabhupada was very clear, very strict. He stopped it, immediately. He stopped them, called in their tracks, saying, I'm servant of God. I'm Krishna's servant. He didn't allow this misconception to spread, showing also, giving the example to us. So, mantra 13 speaks about parampara, about the difference by different paths, and it speaks about developing goodness. Philip, can you please read at the end of mantra 13? This paragraph, the Lord's inner direction. Where did it start? Okay, here. The unter. From here. Mm-hmm. This paragraph.
Die Unterweisungen, die der Herr von innen her erteilt, läutern das Herz des Gottgeweihten von Hallo durch die Erscheinungsweise der Leidenschaft und Unwissenheit hervorgerufenen Unreinheit.
Louder, if you can.
Okay. Die Unterweisungen, die der Herr von innen her erteilt, läutern das Herz des Gottgeweihten von Hallo durch die Erscheinungsweisen der Leidenschaft und Unwissenheit hervorgerufenen Unreinheiten. Nicht-Gottgeweihte unterstehen der Herrschaft von Leidenschaft und Unwissenheit. Wer unter dem Einfluss der Leidenschaft steht, kann sich nicht von der Begierde nach materiellen Dingen lösen. Und wer von Unwissenheit beeinflusst ist, kann weder erkennen, wer er selbst noch wer der Herr ist. Unter der Herrschaft von Leidenschaft oder Unwissenheit besteht also keine Aussicht auf Selbsterkenntnis. Auch wenn man Gott noch so gut die Kontrolle, auch wenn man noch so gut die Rolle eines religiösen Menschen spielt. Für einen Gottgeweihten wird der Einfluss der Erscheinungsweise der Leidenschaft und Unwissenheit durch die Gnade des Herrn aufgehoben. Und so erwirbt er die Eigenschaft der Tugend, das Merkmal eines vollkommenen Brahman. Jeder kann sich als Brahmana qualifizieren, vorausgesetzt, dass er dem Vater in hingebungsvollen Dienstes unter der Führung eines echten spirituellen Meisters folgt. Im Srimad Bhagavatam heißt es,
Kirata Hunandra Pulinda Pulkasha Abhira Sumbaya Vanaka Sadaya Yenye Chapapa Yadapasraya Sraya Sudyanti Dasmai Prabhavishnave Namaha.
Jedes Lebewesen von niederer Herkunft kann durch die Führung Gotteswissenschaft von selbst offenbart. Wenn er die Gotteswissenschaft kennt, wird er allmählich von seinen materiellen Neigungen frei und sein zweifelnder Geist wird durch die Gnade des Herrn kristallklar. Wenn jemand diese Stufe erreicht, ist er eine befreite Seele und kann den Herrn in jeder Lebensphase wahrnehmen. Dies ist die Vollendung von Shambhava. Wie ist diesem Mantra der Shri Upanishaden beschrieben wird?
Thank you. So, the mind becomes crystal clear by the grace of the Lord. Does it sound nice? And everything becomes crystal clear. So, it's not enough to just call ourselves, yes, I am a devotee, I am this, I am that. We have to actually work on the higher qualities, develop these higher qualities of balance and goodness. And then automatically happiness and enthusiasm appears. And then after that, the path becomes very clear. It becomes very clear how to go, how to proceed further. Krishna. Sorry. And tomorrow at 6:30, we will discuss something very interesting about these hells. These hells, what kind of hell can you get? This is from Mahabharata about the power of chanting, which is very, very special. What spoils our practice of japa meditation, chanting, and what are the possible results that we can get? So let us continue with our exercises of meditating on Krishna's qualities while doing japa meditation and trying to see Krishna in everything and everybody. Even just telling ourselves Krishna is in the heart of the other person, of this person. You can see that even just these simple words can change our perception, can change our attitude. And also, it means that we want to develop respect to everybody and that we want to do something, some acts of kindness or goodness to everybody. So, to the extent of our capacity, let's try to do something good to other people. Just like today in the morning in the Bhagavatam class we were discussing. Was it today? We were discussing charity. Yeah. Yeah, but when you try to do something good for somebody else, it changes our personal mood very much. So just let us practice this. Let us remember that Krishna is in everybody's heart. And we can, and he's happy when we serve his parts. Everybody's body is his temple, and when we serve even just the body of the other person, that's also serving Krishna. Just like when we clean the temple, that's serving the Lord inside. At the same time, we remember that it's not that everybody is God impersonally. All of us are Krishna's servants, and when we manage to accept that I am dasoham, I am a servant, I am not the controller, I am not the enjoyer, as soon as if we are able to give up these two wants, two greeds, to control and to enjoy, if we are able and still perform our duties, then we will be totally in ecstasy, in total bliss. So the practice is, this is the practice of yoga. We work, and we, moreover, most of us are lucky that we can do direct service. We are doing some service in the temple, so this is very directly connected to Krishna. But so we are very lucky. But still, we may have some desire for enjoy or for controllership. So if we consciously find this and surrender, give up this desire for control and enjoyership and try to do this for Krishna's pleasure. That's what makes it much easier. So again, as in usual yoga or in Buddhism or in some other cultures, it's very difficult to work and not be the worker at the same time. It's almost impossible. And that's why liberation is so rare. It's considered such a rare thing. But for a devotee, you do actually for the pleasure of the Lord. And you feel it. You feel the response. When you just try to do something for Krishna, you can feel the yoga, you can feel the connection that yes, Krishna is there, Krishna is responding, Krishna is accepting the service, and Krishna is giving some response from the heart, from outside, through other devotees, through the books, and also from your heart, from your own heart. This way you can experience what other yogas require years and decades for. So in other yogas we need many, many years and sometimes decades, if not lifetimes of practice to get the yoga, to get this connection to transcendence. Here, by bhakti, in the matter of just a few weeks, for some of us, I experienced this amazing phenomenon after a few weeks of doing the devotional service. Or even it may be just after a few hours when we chant, you know, we chant, join a good kirtan, and in just 1 hour you can achieve samadhi, or can get beyond the platform of mind. So thank you very much. These are some of the exercises. Remember Krishna's qualities. See Krishna in everybody's heart. Practicing Krishna in everybody's heart. Do acts of kindness to others. And tomorrow we meet at 6:30 to complete mantra 14. Maybe Krishna Premarupa returns tomorrow, so we will maybe have also him. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. Please accept my humble obeisances. Patitanam pavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namaha. On the altar. Then you have to maybe use the recording.